Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, for those of you interested in more on the immigration debate, you may be interested in my Wednesday night television show tonight. That's at 7:30 tonight on CUNY TV, Channel 75 on the New York City cable systems. We'll continue the immigration debate there when the sun goes down. Right now, we begin a summer series on New York City's public housing. Over the next few months, we'll be getting different opinions and taking lots of calls on public housing's past, present, and future. We begin the series with social critic and historian Nathan Glazer. His new book about the city and modern architecture includes a detailed critique of why the city's public housing projects were built the way they were and with what effects on the residents. The book is called From a Cause to a Style, Modernist Architecture's Encounter with the American City, published by the Princeton University Press. Nathan Glazer's long body of work, as some of you know, includes classics like The Limits of Social Policy, We Are All Multiculturalists Now, and Beyond the Melting Pot, written in the 1960s with Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He is Professor Emeritus of Sociology and Education at Harvard. And Dr. Glazer, thanks for coming back on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to talk... Go ahead.
We don't get NYC in Boston, but...
That's okay. You get WBUR up there, not a bad station in its own right.
Okay, yes.
I want to talk mostly about the part of your book that's about public housing, but give us the larger context first. When you say modernist architecture was a cause, not simply another style, what was the cause and what were its origins?
Well, the cause was to improve the city. Modernist architecture begins... in the early 20th century, various tendencies. One of those tendencies was aesthetic and design-oriented, and it's very important. That is the notion of getting rid of ornament in architecture, of elaboration in architecture, and of historical styles in architecture. But another side of modernism, which was equally important to my mind, was reforming the industrial city, the city that is crowded, multifarious, varied, dirty, and organizing it in some rational way. There, the chief prophet for modernism was the Swiss architect Le Corbusier, and the chief image that he proposed for the city was what became known as the Tower in a Park. That is the tall building making use of the expensive land of the city to build up, but then taking advantage of the fact that it was building up by leaving a lot of open space around it and a lot of room for expressways and rapid traffic. So this was a kind of a prophetic image of the city, first proposed really by him in the 1920s, and in measure realized after World War II through the building of housing projects in the U.S. or what were called housing estates in England.
Right. So the style of them, the big public housing projects that we all know in New York City, large towers inside open space of playgrounds and sitting areas. These fit in with the modernist architect's cause?
This was the cause had large objectives. It would improve the city. The mechanisms that it had proposed turned out to have problems of their own, in part design problems, but even larger. And I think what really led to the gradual disillusion with the housing project was the social problems that arose in it, whether in England or in the U.S. or in France or most of the places where they were built.
And we'll get to that. But take us back to 1934, which is the year of the founding of the New York City Public Housing Authority, with its first chairman, who you write about in the book, Langdon Post. And you use housing projects in East Harlem in particular as your case study here. How did Langdon Post see East Harlem in the 1930s as the Housing Authority was created?
Well, it wasn't only Langdon Post. It was everyone else who thought about cities. I would put in the among the forefront LaGuardia, Mayor LaGuardia himself, as well as all the housing reformers. What they saw were crowded blocks, 4 or 5 stories high, occupying the entire street front, leaving no open space on the street side, a little bit in the back because of regulations limiting how much of the plot you could cover. And they saw them as having insufficient access to light, insufficient access to air, poorly built, and so on. You can see pictures of East Harlem in some of the exhibits recently in New York on Robert Moses and the kind of areas he tore down.
And this is somewhat case. This is somewhat personal for you, because you tell us in the book that the East Harlem blocks where you grew up in private housing got torn down and replaced with what became the George Washington houses, that series of 14-story buildings on a square.
Right.
What blocks were those that no longer exist?
Well, I was born on 103rd Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. And
what was it like there when you were growing up?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it was urban life, and it was obviously people had no money. There were 9 of my family living in 4 rooms. I can't say it was a bad life for a child growing up. You would walk to the library. You would walk to school. My elementary school was literally across the street, and that is the only building of those blocks that survives. They didn't tear down the elementary school, which is still there on 103rd, even though 103rd no longer exists because the street was abolished between 2nd and 3rd Avenue.
To build this big square with the housing project.
At the time, everyone was for housing projects, modern, new equipment, subsidized. Clearly it would take a while before the cockroaches and the bedbugs arrived, and that was all to the best. The problems that arose, but less in, oddly enough, in the New York City housing projects and elsewhere, were the social problems, a problem of a style of life that was different from those around one, which, as I say, was more marked in other cities where more people lived in houses and individually owned houses. But the main problem in housing projects generally was the concentration of people in poverty. And the concentration of people in poverty meant the concentration of their problems. Now, in a way, the housing project, and I do say this in the book, was attacked on its design side from the problems that emerged on its social side. As I say, New York was best off because here we were used to living in taller buildings, and here also the housing projects were well run. Mm-hmm. But on the side of producing what I might call urban amenity, what we mean by the better part of urban living, access to stores and institutions and facilities and to a lively street life, the New York Housing Project was as badly off as the others.
It is amazing.
And that, I think, was the problem. The notion of the Tower in a Park vision, which had many virtues, the virtue of bringing in light, air, space, and so on. But what it lacked was the problem of dealing with what we might call a humanistic urbanism, the urbanism of complexity, the urbanism of variety, and that it could not recreate.
It is amazing to think how
urbanism that in a way it eliminated in order to build a housing project.
Right. It is amazing to think how big some of these, housing project areas are, and that there are no stores within them, and so people have to go completely outside for that kind of commercial life, or for that matter, basic necessities. You know, I want to open up the phones for only for this call-in. Anyone who lives now or has ever lived in a housing project in East Harlem only. Now, I don't know if we're going to have you in our audience right at this moment, but if you live now or have ever lived in a housing project in East Harlem, what's good or what was good or bad about your project. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, as we continue with Nathan Glaser, whose new book is called From a Cause to a Style, Modernist Architecture's Encounter with the American City. And Professor Glaser, you wanted to say something else about the square and the stores?
Well, actually, I'd like to listen to what the callers in have to say.
Well, we'll see.
That's always crucial.
Well, so, they're not here yet.
I was saying that in principle, you could have had stores. In principle, you could have had variety. But if you build new, the rents are going to be high. You're not going to have the kind of stores you have, let's say, in an older, poor area where one store can be a garment cleaner, the next one can be a hangout for a local Italian club. You know, that's, mm-hmm. you can't reproduce that easily with new building.
Did the George Washington houses and other projects solve some problems while they created others?
Yes, they solved one big problem, and that is providing basically decent housing with modern facilities for people who could not afford them in the open market. And that is certainly an advantage. That's terribly important. And then this big argument that took place between people like Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs and Roger Starr, who was housing commissioner in the 60s or so, 70s, the 70s more. That was his argument. He says you can't find another way of providing a substantial quantity of housing for people who can't afford it in the open market.
Ariana in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ariana.
Hi, Ariana, that's my name.
Sorry.
It's okay. Well, I lived on 115 and 1st, and I did not like it at all. It was very disgusting. It wasn't well maintained. There was nothing good about the projects that I like. So that's my opinion.
Yeah. Well, what do you have?
I wonder where Ariana lives now.
Where do you live now?
I live in the Bronx now.
In private housing, I presume.
No, it's not housing. No, it's a house.
In private housing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you have, based on your experience, do you have any opinion on the best way to provide housing assistance to poor people?
Well, it's to put more money into the projects, to put more money to clean it and to make it that do not look like a prison. It's like you're in a prison in there. The aesthetic is not good at all. So just put more money in it.
Ariana, thank you very much. Nathan Glaser?
Well, that's a very interesting comment. And, of course, when Ariana refers to it as a prison, she is referring to design. She's referring to a huge scale with rows of equivalent windows and one entry into a huge building, and also private police, because the housing authority has its private police and so on. And what is she? She is describing the way most Americans don't like to live. She's in a house now, and that's what they prefer. And that was a problem. And as is true, we have learned from that. And insofar as we have support for the poor, and we do have substantial programs for housing, we try to, in some way, approximate the private market.
So more Section 8 vouchers.
Section 8, and so on. That is, in a way, came in as a response to the criticism of public housing and the failure, not in New York, but the failure in other places, literally, to be able to get people to live there. So many were blown up in St. Louis, in Newark, and elsewhere, but not in New York.
Banny in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Nice to talk to you.
Same here.
Well, I grew up in the housing projects up in Spanish Harlem, Carver Houses.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved in when they were first built. And, you know, to the family, it was a step up. There was light coming in. There was heat. There was hot water. You know, we had gone to heaven, basically. But through the years, it totally deteriorated to, you know, the buildings weren't kept up. There was drug.
What years are you talking about?
I'm talking about we moved in probably like in the 50s when they did a lot of urban renewal in Spanish Harlem.
Right.
And, you know, they were tearing down all of the tenements. But, you know, I don't think that the problem is that they're high-rise buildings. I don't think that the problem is necessarily the overall design, because if you look at a lot of middle-income housing in New York City, it's, you know, it's that shape, you know, big buildings, elevators, and things like that.
So what do you think the problem was?
Well, I think the problem is two things. One is that the communities were ghettoized. You know, we were separated out from the rest of the city. The other problem is that there were no real estate stores on the bottom floor of those buildings.
No stores, retail stores.
Right. So there was no real foot traffic.
Benny, thank you very much for your call. And Professor Glaser, it is interesting that the design of, you know, towers on a square or towers in a park.
Yeah.
I mean, just from an architectural standpoint, if you compare this to, say, Stuyvesant Town, where people are just dying to get in,
and it
seems like a functional community, but it's the same architecture.
Well, I have said earlier, and I will say again, the issue was the concentration of the poor and the concentration of social problems.
As she said,
your last caller refers to another important issue, and that is maintenance. Maintenance is for many public buildings and public projects, is never really reckoned in properly. I recall speaking to a New York City commissioner who says, the guy who was talking about maintaining the bridges, he says, you can always feel you can do it next year. And so things deteriorate. And this is what happened with public housing. The scheme did not include enough for what is necessary in the way of wear and tear and maintenance. But it is true, in New York, public housing works best because it's similar to the way a lot of other people will live. And as you say, Stuyvesant Town is in tremendous demand. It just sold at a huge price. I don't know how I will confess my ignorance. How did Stuyvesant Town handle the problem of local shopping and stores? Generally, in the projects in East Harlem, you have the stores concentrated along the edges,
it's
Third
the
Avenue and so on.
It's the same
in Stuyvesant Town.
It is the same.
And one of the problems is stupid public regulations. We said, well, the money can only be used for housing, and if you use any part of it for stores, it's illegal, you know. You would think that you can get around that somehow. But strangely enough, we built 160,000 units of public housing and projects, and we never seem to have gotten around it.
You know, we have more calls who, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get to because we're running out of time. But since this is the beginning of a summer series we'll be doing on the public housing projects in New York City, we'll have lots of time for you, Diane, in Manhattan, you, Ibrahim, in the Bronx, and many others to call in this summer with your experiences. But Nathan Glaser, before we run out of time, you conclude in the book that today the two epics of housing reform, big housing projects and the piecemeal restoration of private buildings, seem to live in rough harmony in East Harlem. And I don't want to slough over the fact that public housing, as many complaints as there are about it, is actually better in New York City. And you say better in East Harlem than in the Bronx, and in general better in New York City than many other cities in the country. Why?
Well, I would say there are two reasons. One is, and here is a mystery I can't solve, the public housing authority has always been well managed. It would be inconceivable for the public housing authority to be taken over by the state or by some federal government-appointed official, as happened in Boston, as happened in Cambridge, and has happened in many places. It is a well-managed authority. The second is the New Yorkers are adapted to living densely and in high buildings, and so that the contrast between how the public housing project, the middle class project, as you point out, was from a design point of view, there was really no particular difference from the way people had to live, adapt to those circumstances, elevators, etc. Again, no great difference. So the fact that New York is uniquely a dense and high-rise city, and the fact that there was good management meant that the New York City Housing Authority and its projects were always in better shape. None of them were ever destroyed or abandoned.
And East Harlem housing is better than Bronx public housing, as you write. Why?
Well, I haven't done the study, but I think it's better because it's more like Manhattan, and it's closer to the urban accessories. So I call it amenities. What you need to lead a human urban existence.
Yes, that's what I got from
some of the other areas.
From your book also, is that they're just in areas with more mixed use. So there's more private housing around, there's more stores around, there's more general urban life. Whereas the projects in the Bronx are just much more segregated physically from the rest of urban life. We have to leave it there. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Well, it was good to talk to you, Brian. Thank you for having me on.
Nathan Glazer's new book, From a Cause to a Style, Modernist Architecture's Encounter with the American City, published by the Princeton University Press. It includes that chapter on East Harlem public housing as a case study.